Demon Haunted World, Science as a Candle in the Dark, by Carl Sagan. It was a blustery fall day in 1939. In the streets outside the apartment building, fallen leaves were swirling in little whirlwinds, each with a life of its own. It was good to be inside and warm and safe, with my mother preparing dinner in the next room. In our apartment, there were no older kids who picked on you for no reason. Just the week before, I had been in a fight. I can't remember, after all these years, who it was with. Maybe it was Sniniagata from the third floor. And after a wild swing, I found I'd put my fist through the plate glass window of Schechter's drugstore. Mr. Schechter was solicitous. "It's all right, I'm insured," he said, as he put some unbelievably painful antiseptic on my wrist. My mother took me to the doctor, whose office was on the ground floor of our building. With a pair of tweezers, he pulled out a fragment of glass. Using needle and thread, he sewed two stitches. "Two stitches?" my father had repeated later that night. He knew about stitches because he was a cutter in the garment industry. His job was to use a very scary power saw to cut out patterns, backs, say, or sleeves for ladies' coats and suits, from an enormous stack of cloth. Then the patterns were conveyed to endless rows of women sitting at sewing machines. He was pleased I'd gotten angry enough to overcome a natural timidity. Sometimes it was good to fight back. I hadn't planned to do anything violent. It just happened. One moment Snunny was pushing me, and the next moment my fist was through Mr. Schechter's window. I had injured my wrist, generated an unexpected medical expense, broken a plate glass window, and no one was mad at me. As for Snunny, he was more friendly than ever. I puzzled over what the lesson was. But it was much more pleasant to work it out up here in the warmth of the apartment, gazing out through the living room window into Lower New York Bay, than to risk some new misadventure on the streets below. As she often did, my mother had changed her clothes and made up her face in anticipation of my father's arrival. We talked about my fight with Snunny. The sun was almost setting, and together we looked out across the choppy waters. "There are people fighting out there, killing each other," she said, waving vaguely across the Atlantic. I peered intently. "I know," I replied. "I can see them." "No, you can't," she replied, skeptically, almost severely, before returning to the kitchen. "They're too far away." How could she know whether I could see them or not, I wondered. Squinting, I had thought I'd made out a thin strip of land at the horizon, on which tiny figures were pushing and shoving and dueling with swords, as they did in my comic books. But maybe she was right. Maybe it had just been my imagination, a little like the midnight monsters that still, on occasion, awakened me from a deep sleep, my pajamas drenched in sweat, my heart pounding. How can you tell when someone is only imagining? I gazed out across the grey waters until night fell, and I was called to wash my hands for dinner. When he came home, my father swooped me up in his arms. I could feel the cold of the outside world against his one-day growth of beard. On a Sunday in that same year, my father had patiently explained to me about zero as a placeholder in arithmetic, about the wicked-sounding names of big numbers, and about how there's no biggest number. "You can always add one," he pointed out. Suddenly, I was seized by a childish compulsion to write in sequence all the integers from 1 to 1,000. We had no pads of paper, but my father offered up the stack of grey cardboards he had been saving from when his shirts were sent to the laundry. I started the project eagerly, but was surprised at how slowly it went. When I had gotten no farther than the low hundreds, my mother announced that it was time for me to take my bath. I was disconsolate. I had to get to 1,000. A mediator his whole life, my father intervened. If I would cheerfully submit to the bath, he would continue the sequence. I was overjoyed. By the time I emerged, he was approaching 900, and I was able to reach 1,000 only a little past my ordinary bedtime. The magnitude of large numbers has never ceased to impress me. Also in 1939, my parents took me to the New York World's Fair. There I was offered a vision of a perfect future made possible by science and high technology. A time capsule was buried, packed with artifacts of our time for the benefit of those in the far future who, astonishingly, might not know much about the people of 1939. The world of tomorrow would be sleek, clean, streamlined, and, as far as I could tell, without a trace of poor people. "See sound," one exhibit bewilderingly commanded, and sure enough, when the tuning fork was struck by the little hammer, a beautiful sine wave marched across the oscilloscope screen. "Hear light," another poster exhorted. And sure enough, when the flashlight shone on the photocell, I could hear something like the static on our Motorola radio set when the dial was between stations. Plainly, the world held wonders of a kind I had never guessed. How could a tone become a picture and light become a noise? My parents were not scientists. They knew almost nothing about science. But in introducing me simultaneously to skepticism and to wonder, they taught me the two uneasily cohabiting modes of thought that are central to the scientific method. They were only one step out of poverty, but when I announced that I wanted to be an astronomer, I received unqualified support, even if they, as I, had only the most rudimentary idea of what an astronomer does. They never suggested that, all things considered, it might be better to be a doctor or a lawyer. I wish I could tell you about inspirational teachers in science from my elementary or junior high or high school days, but as I think back on it, there were none. There was rote memorization about the periodic table of the elements, levers and inclined planes, green plant photosynthesis, and the difference between anthracite and bituminous coal. But there was no soaring sense of wonder, no hint of an evolutionary perspective, and nothing about mistaken ideas that everybody had once believed. In high school laboratory courses, there was an answer we were supposed to get. We were marked off if we didn't get it. There was no encouragement to pursue our own interests or hunches or conceptual mistakes. In the backs of textbooks, there was material you could tell was interesting. The school year would always end before we got to it. You could find wonderful books on astronomy, say, in the libraries, but not in the classroom. Long division was taught as a set of rules from a cookbook, with no explanation of how this particular sequence of short divisions, multiplications, and subtractions got you the right answer. In high school, extracting square roots was offered reverentially, as if it were a method once handed down from Mount Sinai. It was our job merely to remember what we had been commanded. Get the right answer, and never mind that you don't understand what you're doing. I had a very capable second-year algebra teacher from whom I learned much mathematics, but he was also a bully who enjoyed reducing young women to tears. My interest in science was maintained through all those school years by reading books and magazines on science fact and fiction. College was the fulfillment of my dreams. I found teachers who not only understood science, but who were actually able to explain it. I was lucky enough to attend one of the great institutions of learning of the time, the University of Chicago. I was a physics student in a department orbiting around Enrico Fermi. I discovered what true mathematical elegance is from Subramanian Chandrasekhar. I was given the chance to talk chemistry with Harold Urey. Over summers, I was apprenticed in biology to H.J. Muller at Indiana University, and I learned planetary astronomy from its only full-time practitioner at the time, G.P. Kuiper. It was from Kuiper that I first got a feeling for what is called a back-of-the-envelope calculation. A possible explanation to a problem occurs to you. You pull out an old envelope, appeal to your knowledge of fundamental physics, scribble a few approximate equations on the envelope, substitute in likely numerical values, and see if your answer comes anywhere near explaining your problem. If not, you look for a different explanation. It cut through nonsense like a knife through butter. At the University of Chicago, I also was lucky enough to go through a general education program devised by Robert M. Hutchins, where science was presented as an integral part of the gorgeous tapestry of human knowledge. It was considered unthinkable for an aspiring physicist not to know Plato, Aristotle, Bach, Shakespeare, Gibbon, Malinowski, and Freud, among many others. In an introductory science class, Ptolemy's view that the sun revolved around the earth was presented so compellingly that some students found themselves re-evaluating their commitment to Copernicus. The status of the teachers in the Hutchins curriculum had almost nothing to do with their research. Perversely, unlike the American university standard of today, teachers were valued for their teaching, their ability to inform and inspire the next generation. In this heady atmosphere, I was able to fill in some of the many gaps in my education. Much that had been deeply mysterious, and not just in science, became clearer. I also witnessed at first hand the joy felt by those whose privilege it is to uncover a little about how the universe works. I've always been grateful to my mentors of the 1950s, and tried to make sure that each of them knew my appreciation. But as I look back, it seems clear to me that I learned the most essential things not from my schoolteachers, nor even from my university professors, but from my parents, who knew nothing at all about science in that single, far-off year of 1939. As I got off the plane, he was waiting for me, holding up a scrap of cardboard with my name scribbled on it. I was on my way to a conference of scientists and TV broadcasters devoted to the seemingly hopeless prospect of improving the presentation of science on commercial television. The organizers had kindly sent a driver. Do you mind if I ask you a question? He said, as we waited for my bag. No, I didn't mind. Isn't it confusing to have the same name as that scientist guy? It took me a moment to understand. Was he pulling my leg? Finally, it dawned on me. I am that scientist guy, I answered. He paused and then smiled. Sorry, that's my problem. I thought it was yours, too. He put out his hand. My name is William F. Buckley. Well, he wasn't exactly William F. Buckley, but he did bear the name of a contentious and well-known TV interviewer, for which he doubtless took a lot of good-natured ribbing. As we settled into the car for the long drive, the windshield wipers rhythmically thwacking, he told me he was glad I was that scientist guy. He had so many questions to ask about science. Would I mind? No, I didn't mind. And so we got to talking, but not, as it turned out, about science. He wanted to talk about frozen extraterrestrials languishing in an Air Force base near San Antonio. Channeling, a way to hear what's on the minds of dead people. Not much, it turns out. Crystals, the prophecies of Nostradamus, astrology, the Shroud of Turin. He introduced each portentous subject with buoyant enthusiasm. Each time I had to disappoint him. The evidence is crummy, I kept saying. There's a much simpler explanation. He was, in a way, widely read. He knew the various speculative nuances on, let's say, the sunken continents of Atlantis and Lemuria. He had at his fingertips what underwater expeditions were supposedly just setting out to find the tumbled columns and broken minarets of a once great civilization whose remains were now visited only by deep-sea luminescent fish and giant kraken. Except, while the ocean keeps many secrets, I knew that there isn't a trace of oceanographic or geophysical support for Atlantis and Lemuria. As far as science can tell, they never existed. By now, a little reluctantly, I told him so. As we drove through the rain, I could see him getting glummer and glummer. I was dismissing not just some errant doctrine, but a precious facet of his inner life. And yet there's so much in real science that's equally exciting, more mysterious, a greater intellectual challenge, as well as being a lot closer to the truth. Did he know about the molecular building blocks of life sitting out there in the cold, tenuous gas between the stars? Had he heard of the footprints of our ancestors found in 4 million-year-old volcanic ash? What about the raising of the Himalayas when India went crashing into Asia? Or how viruses, built like hypodermic syringes, slip their DNA past the host organism's defenses and subvert the reproductive machinery of cells? Or the radio search for extraterrestrial intelligence? Or the newly discovered ancient civilization of Ebla that advertised the virtues of Ebla beer? No, he hadn't heard. Nor did he know, even vaguely, about quantum indeterminacy, and he recognized DNA only as 3 frequently linked capital letters. Mr. Buckley, well-spoken, intelligent, curious, had heard virtually nothing of modern science. He had a natural appetite for the wonders of the universe. He wanted to know about science. It's just that all the science had gotten filtered out before it reached him. Our cultural motifs, our educational system, our communications media had failed this man. What the society permitted to trickle through was mainly pretense and confusion. It had never taught him how to distinguish real science from the cheap imitation. He knew nothing about how science works. There are hundreds of books about Atlantis, the mythical continent that is said to have existed something like 10,000 years ago in the Atlantic Ocean, or somewhere, a recent book locates it in Antarctica. The story goes back to Plato, who reported it as hearsay coming down to him from remote ages. Recent books authoritatively describe the high level of Atlantean technology, morals, and spirituality, and the great tragedy of an entire populated continent sinking beneath the waves. There is a New Age Atlantis, the legendary civilization of advanced sciences, chiefly devoted to the science of crystals. In a trilogy called Crystal Enlightenment by Katrina Raphael, the books mainly responsible for the crystal craze in America, Atlantean crystals read minds, transmit thoughts, are the repositories of ancient history and the model and source of the pyramids of Egypt. Nothing approximating evidence is offered to support these assertions. What we almost never find, in public libraries or newsstand magazines or primetime television programs, is the evidence from seafloor spreading and plate tectonics, and from mapping the ocean floor, which shows quite unmistakably that there could have been no continent between Europe and the Americas on anything like the timescale proposed. Spurious accounts that snare the gullible are readily available. Skeptical treatments are much harder to find. Skepticism does not sell well. A bright and curious person who relies entirely on popular culture to be informed about something like Atlantis is hundreds or thousands of times more likely to come upon a fable treated uncritically than a sober and balanced assessment. Maybe Mr. Buckley should know to be more skeptical about what's dished out to him by popular culture. But apart from that, it's hard to see how it's his fault. He simply accepted what the most widely available and accessible sources of information claimed was true. For his naivete, he was systematically misled and bamboozled. All over the world, there are enormous numbers of smart, even gifted people who harbor a passion for science. But that passion is unrequited. Surveys suggest that some 95% of Americans are scientifically illiterate. The consequences of scientific illiteracy are far more dangerous in our time than in any that has come before. It's perilous and foolhardy for the average citizen to remain ignorant about global warming, say, or ozone depletion, air pollution, toxic and radioactive wastes, acid rain, topsoil erosion, tropical deforestation, exponential population growth. Jobs and wages depend on science and technology. If our nation can't manufacture, at high quality and low price, products people want to buy, then industries will continue to drift away and transfer a little more prosperity to other parts of the world. Consider the social ramifications of fission and fusion power, supercomputers, data highways, abortion, radon, massive reductions in strategic weapons, addiction, government eavesdropping on the lives of its citizens, high-resolution TV, airline and airport safety, fetal tissue transplants, health costs, food additives, drugs to ameliorate mania or depression or schizophrenia, animal rights, superconductivity, morning-after pills, alleged hereditary antisocial predispositions, space stations, going to Mars, finding cures for AIDS and cancer. How can we affect national policy or even make intelligent decisions in our own lives if we don't grasp the underlying issues? As I write, Congress is dissolving its own Office of Technology Assessment, the only organization specifically tasked to provide advice to the House and Senate on science and technology. Its competence and integrity over the years have been exemplary. Of the 535 members of the U.S. Congress, rarely in the 20th century have as many as 1% had any significant background in science. The last scientifically literate president may have been Thomas Jefferson. So how do Americans decide these matters? How do they instruct their representatives? Who, in fact, makes these decisions? And on what basis? Diseases that once tragically carried off countless infants and children have been progressively mitigated and cured by science. Through the discovery of the microbial world, via the insight that physicians and midwives should wash their hands and sterilize their instruments, through nutrition, public health and sanitation measures, antibiotics, drugs, vaccines, the uncovering of the molecular structure of DNA, molecular biology, and now gene therapy. In the developed world, at least, parents today have an enormously better chance of seeing their children live to adulthood than did the heir to the throne of one of the most powerful nations on earth in the late 17th century. Smallpox has been wiped out worldwide. The area of our planet infested with malaria-carrying mosquitoes has dramatically shrunk. The number of years a child diagnosed with leukemia can expect to live has been increasing progressively, year by year. Science permits the Earth to feed about 100 times more humans and under conditions much less grim than it could a few thousand years ago. We can pray over the cholera victim, or we can give her 500 milligrams of tetracycline every 12 hours. We can try nearly futile psychoanalytic talk therapy on the schizophrenic patient, or we can give him 300 to 500 milligrams a day of clozapine. The scientific treatments are hundreds or thousands of times more effective than the alternatives. And even when the alternatives seem to work, we don't actually know that they played any role. Spontaneous remissions, even of cholera and schizophrenia, can occur without prayer and without psychoanalysis. Abandoning science means abandoning much more than air conditioning, CD players, hair dryers, and fast cars. In hunter-gatherer pre-agricultural times, the human life expectancy was about 20 to 30 years. That's also what it was in Western Europe in late Roman and in medieval times. It didn't rise to 40 years until around the year 1870. It reached 50 in 1915, 60 in 1930, 70 in 1955, and is today approaching 80, a little more for women, a little less for men. The rest of the world is retracing the European increment in longevity. What is the cause of this stunning, unprecedented humanitarian transition? The germ theory of disease, public health measures, medicines, and medical technology. Longevity is perhaps the best single measure of the physical quality of life. If you're dead, there's little you can do to be happy. This is a precious offering from science to humanity, nothing less than the gift of life. But microorganisms mutate. New diseases spread like wildfire. There is a constant battle between microbial measures and human countermeasures. We keep pace in this competition, not just by designing new drugs and treatments, but by penetrating progressively more deeply toward an understanding of the nature of life. Basic research. I know that science and technology are not just cornucopias pouring gifts out into the world. Scientists not only conceived nuclear weapons, they also took political leaders by the lapels, arguing that their nation, whichever it happened to be, had to have one first. Then they manufactured over 60,000 of them. During the Cold War, scientists in the United States, the Soviet Union, China, and other nations were willing to expose their own fellow citizens to radiation, in most cases without their knowledge, to prepare for nuclear war. Physicians in Tuskegee, Alabama, misled a group of veterans into thinking they were receiving medical treatment for their syphilis when they were the untreated controls. The atrocious cruelties of Nazi doctors are well known. Our technology has produced thalidomide, CFCs, Agent Orange, nerve gas, pollution of air and water, species extinctions, and industries so powerful they can ruin the climate of the planet. Roughly half the scientists on Earth work at least part-time for the military. While a few scientists are still perceived as outsiders, courageously criticizing the ills of society and providing early warnings of potential technological catastrophes, many are seen as compliant opportunists, or as the willing source of corporate profits and weapons of mass destruction, never mind the long-term consequences. The technological perils that science serves up, its implicit challenge to received wisdom, and its perceived difficulty are all reasons for some people to mistrust and avoid it. There's a reason people are nervous about science and technology. And so the image of the mad scientist haunts our world, down to the white-coated loonies of Saturday morning children's TV and the plethora of Faustian bargains in popular culture, from the eponymous Dr. Faustus himself to Dr. Frankenstein, Dr. Strangelove, and Jurassic Park. But we can't simply conclude that science puts too much power into the hands of morally feeble technologists or corrupt, power-crazed politicians and so decide to get rid of it. Advances in medicine and agriculture have saved vastly more lives than have been lost in all the wars in history. Advances in transportation, communication, and entertainment have transformed and unified the world. In opinion poll after opinion poll, science is rated among the most admired and trusted occupations, despite the misgivings. The sword of science is double-edged. Its awesome power forces on all of us, including politicians, but of course especially on scientists, a new responsibility. More attention to the long-term consequences of technology, a global and transgenerational perspective, an incentive to avoid easy appeals to nationalism and chauvinism. Mistakes are becoming too expensive. Do we care what's true? Does it matter? Where ignorance is bliss, 'tis folly to be wise, wrote the poet Thomas Gray. But is it? Edmund Way Teal, in his 1950 book Circle of the Seasons, understood the dilemma better. It is morally as bad not to care whether a thing is true or not, so long as it makes you feel good, as it is not to care how you got your money, as long as you have got it. It's disheartening to discover government corruption and incompetence, for example, but is it better not to know about it? Whose interest does ignorance serve? If we humans bear, say, hereditary propensities toward the hatred of strangers, isn't self-knowledge the only antidote? If we long to believe that the stars rise and set for us, that we are the reason there is a universe, does science do us a disservice in deflating our conceits? In The Genealogy of Morals, Friedrich Nietzsche, as so many before and after, decries the unbroken progress in the self-belittling of man brought about by the scientific revolution. Nietzsche mourns the loss of man's belief in his dignity, his uniqueness, his irreplaceability in the scheme of existence. For me, it is far better to grasp the universe as it really is than to persist in delusion, however satisfying and reassuring. Which attitude is better geared for our long-term survival? Which gives us more leverage on our future? And if our naive self-confidence is a little undermined in the process, is that altogether such a loss? Is there not cause to welcome it as a maturing and character-building experience? To discover that the universe is some 8 to 15 billion and not 6 to 12,000 years old improves our appreciation of its sweep and grandeur. To entertain the notion that we are a particularly complex arrangement of atoms and not some breath of divinity, at the very least enhances our respect for atoms. To discover, as now seems probable, that our planet is one of billions of other worlds in the Milky Way galaxy, and that our galaxy is one of billions more, majestically expands the arena of what is possible. To find that our ancestors were also the ancestors of apes ties us to the rest of life and makes possible important, if occasionally rueful, reflections on human nature. Plainly, there is no way back. Like it or not, we are stuck with science. We had better make the best of it. When we finally come to terms with it and fully recognize its beauty and its power, we will find, in spiritual as well as in practical matters, that we have made a bargain strongly in our favor. But superstition and pseudoscience keep getting in the way, distracting all the Buckleys among us, providing easy answers, dodging skeptical scrutiny, casually pressing our awe buttons and cheapening the experience, making us routine and comfortable practitioners as well as victims of credulity. Yes, the world would be a more interesting place if there were UFOs lurking in the deep waters off Bermuda and eating ships and planes, or if dead people could take control of our hands and write us messages. It would be fascinating if adolescents were able to make telephone handsets rocket off their cradles just by thinking at them, or if our dreams could, more often than can be explained by chance and our knowledge of the world, accurately foretell the future. These are all instances of pseudoscience. They purport to use the methods and findings of science, while in fact they are faithless to its nature, often because they are based on insufficient evidence or because they ignore clues that point the other way. They ripple with gullibility. With the uninformed cooperation, and often the cynical connivance, of newspapers, magazines, book publishers, radio, television, movie producers and the like, such ideas are easily and widely available. Far more difficult to come upon, as I was reminded by my encounter with Mr. Buckley, are the alternative, more challenging and even more dazzling findings of science. Pseudoscience is easier to contrive than science, because distracting confrontations with reality, where we cannot control the outcome of the comparison, are more readily avoided. The standards of argument, what passes for evidence, are much more relaxed. In part for these same reasons, it is much easier to present pseudoscience to the general public than science. But this isn't enough to explain its popularity. Naturally, people try various belief systems on for size, to see if they help. And if we're desperate enough, we become all too willing to abandon what may be perceived as the heavy burden of skepticism. Pseudoscience speaks to powerful emotional needs that science often leaves unfulfilled. It caters to fantasies about personal powers we lack and long for, like those attributed to comic book superheroes today, and earlier to the gods. In some of its manifestations, it offers satisfaction of spiritual hungers, cures for disease, promises that death is not the end. It reassures us of our cosmic centrality and importance. It vouchsafes that we are hooked up with, tied to, the universe. Sometimes it's a kind of halfway house between old religion and new science, mistrusted by both. At the heart of some pseudoscience, and some religion also, new age and old, is the idea that wishing makes it so. How satisfying it would be, as in folklore and children's stories, to fulfill our heart's desire just by wishing. How seductive this notion is, especially when compared with the hard work and good luck usually required to achieve our hopes. The enchanted fish or the genie from the lamp will grant us three wishes, anything we want except more wishes. Who has not pondered, just to be on the safe side, just in case we ever come upon and accidentally rub an old squat brass oil lamp, what to ask for? I remember, from childhood comic strips and books, a top-hatted mustachioed magician who brandished an ebony walking stick. His name was Zatara. He could make anything happen, anything at all. How did he do it? Easy. He uttered his commands backwards. So if he wanted $1,000,000, he would say, Sralad noilim ayemivig. That's all there was to it. It was something like prayer, but much surer of results. I spent a lot of time at age 8 experimenting in this vein, commanding stones to levitate. Ezir enots. It never worked. I blamed my pronunciation. Most of the case histories I will relate in this book are American, because these are the cases I know best, not because pseudoscience and mysticism are more prominent in the United States than elsewhere. But the psychic spoonbender and extraterrestrial channeler Uri Geller hails from Israel. As tensions rise between Algerian secularists and Muslim fundamentalists, more and more people are discreetly consulting the country's 10,000 soothsayers and clairvoyants, about half of whom operate with a license from the government. High French officials, including a former president of France, arranged for millions of dollars to be invested in a scam, the Elf Aquitaine scandal, to find new petroleum reserves from the air. In Germany, there is concern about carcinogenic earth rays, undetectable by science. They can be sensed only by experienced dowsers brandishing forked sticks. Psychic surgery flourishes in the Philippines. Ghosts are something of a national obsession in Britain. Since World War II, Japan has spawned enormous numbers of new religions featuring the supernatural. An estimated 100,000 fortune tellers flourish in Japan. The clientele are mainly young women. Aum Shinrikyo, a sect thought to be involved in the release of the nerve gas sarin in the Tokyo subway system in March 1995, features levitation, faith healing, and ESP among its main tenets. Followers, at a high price, drank the miracle pond water from the bath of Asahara, their leader. In Thailand, diseases are treated with pills manufactured from pulverized sacred scripture. Witches are today being burned in South Africa. Australian peacekeeping forces in Haiti rescue a woman tied to a tree. She is accused of flying from rooftop to rooftop and sucking the blood of children. Astrology is rife in India, geomancy widespread in China. At each relinquishing of civil controls and scientific education, another little spurt in pseudoscience occurs. Leon Trotsky described it for Germany on the eve of the Hitler takeover, but in a description that might equally have applied to the Soviet Union of 1933. Not only in peasant homes, but also in city skyscrapers, there lives alongside the 20th century the 13th. 100 million people use electricity and still believe in the magic powers of signs and exorcisms. Movie stars go to mediums. Aviators who pilot miraculous mechanisms created by man's genius wear amulets on their sweaters. What inexhaustible reserves they possess of darkness, ignorance, and savagery. Russia is an instructive case. Post-communism, many Russians view science with suspicion. When the lid was lifted, as was also true of virulent ethnic hatreds, what had all along been bubbling subsurface was exposed to view. The region is now awash in UFOs, poltergeists, faith healers, quack medicines, magic waters, and old-time superstition. A stunning decline in life expectancy, increasing infant mortality, rampant epidemic disease, subminimal medical standards, and ignorance of preventative medicine all work to raise the threshold at which skepticism is triggered in an increasingly desperate population. As I write, the electorally most popular member of the Duma, a leading supporter of the ultranationalist Vladimir Zhirinovsky, is one Anatoly Kasparovsky, a faith healer who remotely cures diseases ranging from hernias to AIDS by glaring at you out of your television set. His face starts stopped clocks. A somewhat analogous situation exists in China. After the death of Mao Zedong and the gradual emergence of a market economy, UFOs, channeling, and other examples of Western pseudoscience emerged, along with such ancient Chinese practices as ancestor worship, astrology, and fortune-telling, especially that version that involves throwing yarrow sticks and working through the hoary tetragrams of the I Ching. The government newspaper lamented that the superstition of feudal ideology is reviving in our countryside. It was, and remains, a rural, not primarily an urban, affliction. Individuals with special powers gained enormous followings. They could, they said, project chi, the energy field of the universe, out of their bodies to change the molecular structure of a chemical 2,000 kilometers away, to communicate with aliens, to cure diseases. Some patients died under the ministrations of one of these masters of Qigong, who was arrested and convicted in 1993. Wang Hongcheng, an amateur chemist, claimed to have synthesized a liquid, small amounts of which, when added to water, would convert it to gasoline, or the equivalent. For a time, he was funded by the army and the secret police, but when his invention was found to be a scam, he was arrested and imprisoned. Naturally, the story spread that his misfortune resulted not from fraud, but from his unwillingness to reveal his secret formula to the government. Similar stories have circulated in America for decades, usually with a government role replaced by a major oil or auto company. So pseudoscience in America is part of a global trend. Its causes, dangers, diagnosis, and treatment are likely to be similar everywhere. Here, psychics ply their wares on extended television commercials, personally endorsed by entertainers. They have their own channel, the Psychic Friends Network. 1 million people a year sign on and use such guidance in their everyday lives. For the CEOs of major corporations, for financial analysts, for lawyers and bankers, there is a species of astrologer-soothsayer psychic ready to advise on any matter. If people knew how many people, especially the very rich and powerful ones, went to psychics, their jaws would drop through the floor, says a psychic from Cleveland, Ohio. Royalty has traditionally been vulnerable to psychic frauds. In ancient China and Rome, astrology was the exclusive property of the emperor. Any private use of this potent art was considered a capital offense. Emerging from a particularly credulous Southern California culture, Nancy and Ronald Reagan relied on an astrologer in private and public matters, unknown to the voting public. Some portion of the decision-making that influences the future of our civilization is plainly in the hands of charlatans. If anything, the practice is comparatively muted in America. Its venue is worldwide. As amusing as some of pseudoscience may seem, as confident as we may be that we would never be so gullible as to be swept up by such a doctrine, we know it's happening all around us. Transcendental meditation and Aum Shinrikyo seem to have attracted a large number of accomplished people, some with advanced degrees in physics or engineering. These are not doctrines for nitwits. Something else is going on. What's more, no one interested in what religions are and how they begin can ignore them. While vast barriers may seem to stretch between a local, single-focused contention of pseudoscience and something like a world religion, the partitions are very thin. The world presents us with nearly insurmountable problems. A wide variety of solutions are offered, some of very limited worldview, some of portentous sweep. In the usual Darwinian natural selection of doctrines, some thrive for a time, while most quickly vanish. But a few, sometimes, as history has shown, the most scruffy and least prepossessing among them, may have the power to profoundly change the history of the world. The continuum stretching from ill-practiced science, pseudoscience and superstition, new age or old, all the way to respectable mystery religion based on revelation, is indistinct. I try not to use the word cult in this book, in its usual meaning of a religion the speaker dislikes, but try to reach for the headstone of knowledge. Do they really know what they claim to know? Everyone, it turns out, has relevant expertise. In certain passages of this book, I will be critical of the excesses of theology, because at the extremes it is difficult to distinguish pseudoscience from rigid doctrinaire religion. Nevertheless, I want to acknowledge at the outset the prodigious diversity and complexity of religious thought and practice over the millennia, the growth of liberal religion and ecumenical fellowship during the last century, and the fact that, as in the Protestant Reformation, the rise of Reform Judaism, Vatican II, and the so-called higher criticism of the Bible, religion has fought, with varying degrees of success, its own excesses. But in parallel to the many scientists who seem reluctant to debate or even publicly discuss pseudoscience, many proponents of mainstream religions are reluctant to take on extreme conservatives and fundamentalists. If the trend continues, eventually the field is theirs. They can win the debate by default. One religious leader writes to me of his longing for disciplined integrity in religion. We have grown far too sentimental. Devotionalism and cheap psychology on one side, and arrogance and dogmatic intolerance on the other, distort authentic religious life almost beyond recognition. Sometimes I come close to despair, but then I live tenaciously and always with hope. Honest religion, more familiar than its critics with the distortions and absurdities perpetrated in its name, has an active interest in encouraging a healthy skepticism for its own purposes. There is the possibility for religion and science to forge a potent partnership against pseudoscience. Strangely, I think it would soon be engaged also in opposing pseudo-religion.